It is 7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, John C. Harrington. John C. Harrington is president of Harrington Investments Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. He is also the manager of Global Partners LLC, a social venture fund. He is the former president and chairman of the board of Working Assets Management Company and is the former chairman of the board of Progressive Asset Management, a full-service brokerage firm specializing in socially responsible investing. And he is the author of several books, Investing with Your Conscience, and in town to talk about his new book, The Challenge to Power, Money, Investing, and Democracy. John, thank you for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mike.
Let me begin. Ask you, what was the motivation in writing your current book, The Challenge to Power?
Well, I think the first motivation was that memory is great because sometimes you lose it. And when I wrote the first book, I promised myself I'd never write another one, but I did. So obviously I lost my memory, a little dementia here. But I think the major focus of the book, and I hope some of the talking that I'll be doing, is the fact that we really need to protect our democracy, and we are all challenged, and the challenge to power is the power of corporate wealth and power by corporate management, and how we've got to begin to exercise not only our democratic voice, but also our ownership voice, and connect again ownership with control.
Well, I think you'd get very little argument that corporations have a significant amount of power these days, if not complete control over our democracy. Talk a bit about viable ways you see as getting back citizen control over the corporations.
Well, I think first you have to realize what you can do and what you can't do as a shareholder. Simply put, shareholders now have no right to nominate corporate directors. And when you vote your shares, even if you vote withhold against directors or a director, you are not voting against the director or directors. You're simply withholding your proxy. So one of the issues, of course, is number one, shareholders need to be able to nominate directors. Number two, you should be able to vote against directors. So even if, for example, 90% of the shareholders withhold their proxy from management, the entire slate of management directors are reelected, even if there's actually only one vote cast in their favor. So it's Stalin would have loved this system. It's a great one-party system. And then, you know, if you go even further, you have to realize that when you introduce a shareholder resolution, which is to actually raise an issue at the corporate management level, it is generally only advisory. So, for example, a few months ago, there was a resolution before Charles Schwab and Company to eliminate staggered board terms. Many boards now have what are called classified boards, and what that means is the directors are not all elected at one time. They're elected over a three-year period. So even if you bought the company and you owned 80 or 90% of the stock, you couldn't even control the board of directors in the next election. It would take you at least 2 years to control the board. So, you know, it just simply strengthens management's hold over the corporate entity. And at the Schwab meeting, 57% of the shareholders voted in favor of eliminating staggered board terms. And so it's now up to Schwab on whether or not they're gonna carry that out. But again, it's only advisory.
So when you say management, do you mean the board of directors and or let's say the CEO as compared to managers within the company?
That's exactly right. I'm talking about top management, and that is that top management basically selects their board members, and oftentimes, of course, they're friends of the CEO or the CFO or the president, and sometimes the president, CEO, and chairman of the board are all one person. So, you know, management has very, very strong control over the board, and then they nominate themselves. So they're self-nominating, self-perpetuating board, and you can't even vote against them now.
And oftentimes with these larger corporations, people that are on one board are on many boards.
Interlocking directorates. It's very, very common, and it has been since the 30s and 40s that many board members are their bankers, their insurance people. They may be vendors. They may have conflicts of interest with the corporation. They may be attorneys, and in fact, there. I talk a little bit about this in the book. There are a lot of people that that actually sit on the board, and also may have their own legal firm, maybe doing legal business with the corporation. So it's a very incestuous, you know, situation here.
Well, I think the coverage in mainstream media gives one the impression that the shareholders are the ones that are really in charge. They always talk about, oh, well, you know, they're doing all this for the shareholders, and, you know, the shareholders are therefore responsible. But what you're saying is the your average mom-and-pop shareholders don't have really any say.
No, almost no say. And, in fact, really the people who have the say now, if you look at the way ownership of stock has been going, it's been going incredibly toward large institutional investors, large pension funds, mutual funds, banks, insurance companies. And what you have, of course, is you have, even though these big institutions may have, in fact, I think institutional ownership now is about 68% of stocks. So if you look at, you know, the individual investors, rarely, you know, do they have really any say in the corporate boardroom. But even more important, I think you have to realize that that corporate management is doing a great job of convincing people that they actually have, you know, shareholders actually have input and are actually able to say things to the corporation, have, you know, dialogue. But the reality is, if shareholders can't nominate directors and shareholders can't vote against directors, there's very little power.
Now, is it true that many of these people that are on board the board of directors for companies and or CEOs also happen to own extensive chunks of shares within companies?
Well, some do and some don't. I mean, I think going back as far as 1939, when two economists, Burl and Means, talked about, in fact, the book was The Corporation and Private Property. What they really said is there's a separation from ownership and control, and this is, of course, you know, over the last, you know, several decades, been even more extensive. Where the shareholders are a very diverse group. They have very little communication between, you know, shareholders, except again the large institutional shareholders. But they have no control. So what Burl and Means said in 1939 was that shareholders are the owners of shares. The legal owners of corporation had given up control for liquidity. So we have a market which is not in any way connected really to the day-to-day business of the corporation. And one of the major disconnects that we have is the fact that, you know, stocks trade every day. You know, it's like people, you know, there's no ownership, you know, there's no control and ownership connection. So, like the average mutual fund these days, the average stock mutual fund, turns itself over 91% a year. 91% of the stock actually turns over in a mutual fund. So, I mean, there's no connection to ownership. And then if you look at the separation between, you know, the, what are called beneficial owners, which are the people that actually, you know, are the beneficial owners of the stock. There'll be people who own shares of mutual funds. And then, of course, the mutual funds vote their shares for them on their behalf. And then individual shareholders who actually don't buy a mutual fund but just buy stock in and of itself are the beneficial owners, and the voting rights are passed through, say, a brokerage firm. So it's a very convoluted, complex system where you know, there's absolutely no control now over these corporate entities. They're beasts that have run sort of amok, I say, in the book, but there was a guy named Joel Bacon who wrote a book called The Corporation. In fact, there's a movie called The Corporation, which says corporations have just, I mean, they're like prehistoric beasts. They're just crashing through everything and running amok, and there's very little control over them. In fact, I think we've lost our sovereignty to these corporations.
Yeah, I think they equate in the movie The Corporation, they equate corporations to a psychopath.
That's exactly right, yes.
and they justify it very well. Talk about then the idea of socially responsible investing? Because if the shareholders have no power, then how do you change this beast from within?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult, and that's why one of the titles of the chapter or subtitle is, we're running out of time, because I think we have very little time left to begin to challenge the corporate beast. And there are a variety of ways to do that, and I think one of the things that individuals need to think about is really clearly understand the power they have with money, and there are three parts of that power. One is, simply your investing, your conscientious appraisal of different ways in which you can invest money and have an impact on society and an impact on your community. And I'll talk just a second about that. But there are two other ways, one of which, of course, is the way you give money away, your philanthropy. I mean, making sure that you're giving money to organizations that are going to carry out their mission and their goals as stated, by the nonprofit organization. So that's a very important way you can have power with your money. Another way, of course, is everybody has this power, and that's the consumption, the way you consume, responsibly consuming. And again, looking at, what you're getting for your money and especially trying to consume locally. And we're very fortunate in along the Pacific coast to have a lot of farmers markets and organics and the ability to really be able to put our money into the local community in a responsible consumption way. And of course, the third way, which is what I focus most on in my book, is responsible investing, and a lot of that has to do with investing in your community, putting money back. I mean, big corporations, large corporate entities suck out money out of the community. They take that money and they go global. And the way they go global, of course, is they go to cheap labor. They go to cheap natural resources. They don't put money back in communities. So what you've got to do is you've got to look at, responsibly investing in your community and having a very diversified portfolio. So you're not only looking for mutual funds and companies that meet at least a minimal social and environmental criteria, but you also look, like we're fortunate in Seattle to have Cascadia Revolving Loan Fund, which is an organization which you literally can loan money to Cascadia, and they loan money to people that normally do not have access to capital, women, minorities, people that are running small businesses. And small businesses, again, are the backbone to a real market economy and your local community. Corporations, they talk a lot about competition and capitalism, but we really don't have capitalism. We have oligopolyism. We have large conglomerates and corporations which are oligopolies, meaning that they control supply or demand or both. And it has very, Walmart is not... does not believe in competition. They believe in controlling markets, and that's very, very frightening when you look at what's going on in local communities now.
So consumerism, what you choose to buy that you ideally need to survive, actually seems more and more to be the only way a lot of people can make their choices in investing, because myself included, I don't have access to a 401k or a pension anymore because of, my choices in work. So,
well, and a lot of times most people don't have, a choice. I mean, more and more we are losing what are called defined benefit plans, which was the basis of most retirement plans were defined benefits, meaning that your employer has a contractual obligation to put money away for you and to manage that money as a fiduciary and to provide you with benefits in the future. Now what's happened is that almost all public agencies and most private corporations have gone to defined contribution plans, and that includes 401ks and SEPs and IRAs and things of this sort. And that means that basically you put money in, maybe the company puts a little money in depending upon whether or not they want to do it or not, and then you're on the hook for your benefits. So you're at the whim of the market. If you make bad investment decisions with your retirement, you're done. I mean, you have no benefits. And that's, again, another reason why there were a lot of people in the socially responsible investment movement which were against the privatization of Social Security. Because, of course, what that does is that gives somebody an amount of money that they can then invest in a private account. And you may say, well, that's great. They have individual choice. The problem is most people really don't have the ability to do the due diligence and to make some long-term investment decisions. And also they're going to be at the whim of advertisers for financial services companies, and they're going to be harking you and pushing you to invest in this fund and that fund. And pretty soon, you know, you're buying at the top and selling at the bottom, and you do it two or three times, and you have no retirement fund left.
Sticking with the socially responsible investing, how much of a window do you see as us having with that? I mean, you're talking about that, you know, we're almost out of time on this.
Well, I think again, there are several issues going on here. One is that we really have to take personal and individual responsibility for ourselves and for our wealth and our money. And we have to look at the, for example, the mutual funds that we do have available. And now there are over 200 socially and environmentally screened funds out there. Some are better than others. Some have, you know, what individuals have to do is they have to look at the prospectus of each mutual fund. They have to look at what's called the statement of additional information. They have to educate themselves on what the social and environmental criteria of the fund is. But also they have to be really clear about what their investment objectives are. And there are lots of funds out there, lots of mutual funds, many of which do have a strong social criteria. But as this industry grows, and now it's over a $2 trillion industry, socially responsible investing, you have now entering the market a lot of what I would consider charlatans and, you know, pretty Main Street, Wall Street firms that, you know, all of a sudden Vanguard has a, you know, socially responsible index fund. Well, I mean, Vanguard was one of the fund families that was the most adamantly opposed to disclosing how mutual funds vote. That now is required by the SEC rule, so we can actually find out how our mutual funds are voting our stock on, you know, on all issues. So I think, again, you know, you have to go back to a lot of individual responsibility. And also, you know, this is clearly connected to democracy. Corporate behavior, you know, again, I talk about this in the book quite a bit, about how corporations so dominate the political system. And what we've got to do is we've got to go back and exercise, you know, our democratic vote. We have to, you know, individuals are not voting as voters. You know, more and more we find out that people aren't exercising their franchise, but more and more voters, even as shareholders, aren't voting. And so even with the little bit of power that we have as shareholders, you know, we've got to exercise it as voters and shareholders and as consumers.
Talk about coordinated corporate campaigns. That is listed as one of the solutions in your book.
Yeah, what I talk about here is when everybody gets together. I mean, one of the things that we often don't understand is that we're, you know, sort of we feel that we're standing out here alone, and you know, shareholders are beginning to get together and people are beginning to get together. And I think if you look at organizations like the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, which is a coalition of church organizations across the United States, if you look at other large shareholders like CalPERS and CalSTRS in California that are beginning to exercise their proxy, I think that's important. But what shareholders have to do is we have to work with people in the community, with non-governmental organizations in the community, social justice organizations. We have to work with environmental organizations like the Sierra Club, which now has their own mutual funds in which file shareholder resolutions. We have to look at organizations that bring people together in the community. And so what coordinated corporate campaigns are is where we have coalitions of shareholders, of voters, of environmental organizations, of church organizations, of labor, which is oftentimes, you know, we've seen organized labor now at stretched to the limit by the fact that that the AFL-CIO now is split up. SEIU and the Teamsters and other unions have moved away from each other in a very uncoordinated fashion. So what we're talking about in a corporate campaign is really focusing a lot of attention by a lot of organizations on individual corporations to affect corporate behavior. And I think the bottom line always in affecting corporate behavior is not morality, is not ethics, it's money. Money is power. Capital is power, and we've got to understand that we have a lot of power in our pocketbook.
And they notice when the money stops flowing in for different things. But at the same time, things like, let's say, boycotts seem to have pretty mixed results.
Yeah, I think boycotts are effective in limited ways on corporations, generally corporations that are very retail, related businesses that are really tied on a quarterly basis to income, onto revenue. So you have to be very careful, when you call for a boycott. If you're going to boycott, for example, General Electric, first of all, you've got to define all the products and services that General Electric is involved in, because it is a large defense contractor. So, generally, it's got to be a more consumer-oriented company. I mean, for example, boycotts are very effective against companies that are in a more competitive market. For example, Starbucks, one of our local companies here, is very responsive to consumer boycotts. We saw that in the whole issue of fair trade coffee. Starbucks was very responsive, I have to say, in making sure that a portion of their coffee, though I think it's way too small a portion of their coffee now, is fair trade, meaning that people that are producing the coffee are getting a minimal amount of money per pound for the production of their coffee, because of course they're totally susceptible to international markets. And where you produce a lot of the same thing in especially developing countries, it's very, very harsh when the market moves against you. People, not only lose their jobs, but they starve to death.
Yeah, the fair trade movement is a good example of, I think, a good union of local grassroots working in, a bigger network.
That's right.
So do you honestly believe that this movement, socially responsible investing, and individuals voting with their dollars is really going to have any significant impact when you look at, as you point out in the book, that, for instance, the idea that the three wealthiest people in this country have the equivalent wealth of the 48 poorest countries? I mean, when you're dealing with, that kind of wealth and that, much control, do, people, individuals as citizens really have any impact?
Well, I think they do. I think what we're looking at is creating an alternative economy. Basically, we're talking about bringing people together to move away from the dominance of a corporate economy. And what that means is creating our own enterprises in our own local communities. It means I participate in the Green Festival in San Francisco, which brings environmentalists together and local entrepreneurs together to develop a green economy. I'm on a board called the Global Citizen Center, where we're actually going to be building a building in San Francisco, which is going to hold a lot of commercial space for nonprofit organizations. I think they need to work together to own their own property, their own building for retail. I mean, there's a huge green economy out there that's growing. There's a huge organic economy, biodiversity economy that's growing by leaps and bounds. And I think that's really what we need to focus on, is being truly sustainable, because these global conglomerates, these oligopolies, are not sustainable entities. And unfortunately, I think probably when we look at the long term, we're going to find that these corporations are not sustainable, and this is where you're probably going to have some major upheavals in the economy, where you know it'll be really nice to be able to have a sustainable local economy, you know, where we're taking care of each other, and you know, we've got to get away from this, you know, privatizing everything. I mean, corporations want to privatize, you know, life itself, and you know, patent life itself. And I think we've got to really understand that we've got to go back to a much more market economy and a free economy and a publicly dictated economy. Because if we don't have control over our own capital, we're in very deep trouble.
We are talking with John C. Harrington. He is author of the new book, The Challenge to Power, Money, Investing, and Democracy. What final thoughts would you like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I mean, I think we've covered most of what I wanted to say. I know that one of the things that we had talked about is CEO compensation, and I think as that becomes looms larger on the horizon, more people are going to be aware that one of the statistics that I use is the fact that that the average the CEO pay to the average worker now is 431 to 1, where in Britain it's 25 to 1, and in Germany it's 13 to 1. And since 1980, CEO pay has gone up 442%, and for the average worker adjusted for inflation, it's gone up 1.6%. So I think the more we understand and point out the fact that there's these tremendous disparities in people of wealth, and like you mentioned, the three richest men having as much net worth as most of the poor countries in the world, is frightening. And again, I think that's I don't think that's sustainable either. So I think inevitably you're going to see some major changes in the economy that are going to affect people of wealth.
And looking at you know, the recent stuff with Enron and WorldCom, those kind of made a big splash, and there was some stuff done with that, but it looks like we still have a very long way to go in corrective actions.
We do, and I think what we need to do too, and looking not only at the power of your pocketbook, but also democracy in and of itself, is we have to go back and look long term. You know, we have to look, you know, 5, 10, 15 years at this, because again, I think we are running out of time. And we always focus on, you know, for example, in democracy, we focus on electing, you know, a progressive, thoughtful person at the national level. But what we've got to do more and more is understand that the people that come from the local communities eventually are the people that are candidates for, you know, the highest office, and in fact, in the world, which is the President of the United States, the CEO of the big corporate United States at this point. So we have to really look to elect, you know, people at the local level, the city council level. I mean, as low as the, you know, the school boards, the sanitation districts, the mosquito abatement districts, the you know, the state legislatures, because these are the people that are the future leaders, and they're the people that we need to really get elected and have them represent us at the national level.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you very much.
We've just been talking with John C. Harrington. He is author of the new book, The Challenge to Power, Money, Investing, and Democracy. And he will be speaking tonight at Elliott Bay Books at 7:30 p.m.